Get connected with WFAN to talk about your favorite teams. The Fan, always live on the free Odyssey app.
All right, 304. McMonagle here with you on The Fan, 888-808-1019. Got you for another two as we take it till 5 o'clock in the warm-up show, 888-808-1019 right here on The Fan on this Monday morning off of a weekend full of barbecues. I talked about it on Saturday. I've been trying to, if there's one thing I can impart on you over the next couple days. And Evan actually reached out to me. He's up and about. I guess it's early morning in France. I'm the morning show out for the lucky French population. So if you're in France, you know where it's at. Odyssey app. You can listen live. I'm not sure what Evan's doing, getting breakfast. I'm told, and I'm going to Italy myself at the end of August. So I'm wondering what breakfast is like, because everybody tells me in Italy that there's really not savory breakfasts, or like there's no, you don't get bacon, egg, and cheeses, you know, you don't get eggs. Breakfast is like, you know, a croissant and a cup of coffee or pastry, like big lunches, you know, big late dinners. But breakfast, which is my favorite meal, I love breakfast. The idea that I'm going to go 2 weeks without having an omelet is like, how is that possible? I'm going to have to, you know, bring my own eggs. Or just go to the grocery store and make them. I'm sure they sell the eggs. I wonder how expensive eggs are. We'll find out. But as Evan's, you know, probably eating pastries filled with stuff he doesn't understand, sitting there, you know, drinking his water because he doesn't drink anything but water. He doesn't have a coffee. He's not going to have a French press coffee there. He's not going to have anything. But he gets to listen to me early on this Saturday, Saturday. I guess mornings, I say Saturday now. On this Monday morning, coming back from the weekend again, and I'm sure the French would really like this, but I've been talking about this, and I had a bunch this weekend. A lot of hot dogs this weekend. If you haven't done it, do it tomorrow. Do it next weekend. Do it the next time you barbecue, the next time you have hot dogs. You do it, okay? I'm telling you right now. You put coleslaw on that hot dog. I can't get enough of it. It is without question my new favorite barbecue thing to eat. Forget the burgers. Forget anything else. I went to a party. This one of my neighbors brought over like grilled cheese, and some of them had like roast beef in them and ham. These little like grilled cheese sliders. They were delicious. I can't stop eating hot dogs with coleslaw on it. It is the best. I've even tried one time a couple years ago when really craving it, I tried it with bologna, just like a bologna sandwich or coleslaw, and figuring hot dogs and bologna are almost the same thing, not nearly the same thing. Don't have a bologna sandwich or coleslaw on it. Don't do that. Don't do that. But the hot dog with coleslaw, and it's perfect too. It's just perfect because I'm a big sauerkraut guy on hot dogs too, but at barbecues, you can't do it. Someone puts out sauerkraut, that thing is cold within 20 minutes. And cold sauerkraut, no thank you. That just doesn't work out. You need piping hot, like, you know, fresh off the dirty water dogs in Manhattan, that thing, that same vat that's been sitting there stewing in the juices. That sauerkraut that's been, you know, 130 degrees for the last 17 years. That's the only way to eat sauerkraut. You can't have cold sauerkraut. And I just don't expect, it's too much to expect someone who's manning the grill to make sure they have hot sauerkraut. It goes in a bowl, it goes on the table, it's cold within 20 minutes. I'm telling you, coleslaw and hot dogs, it's the best. 888-808-1019. So I hope everybody had a good 4th of July. It's back to business. We got another week of baseball, both teams off today. Back to business, a full week of baseball before the All-Star break. And then, of course, football's around the corner. We still got to talk Knicks. I did it on Saturday, but I had a couple days off from the overnight last weekend, Thursday and Friday, so I haven't talked about Mike Brown. We can get into the Knicks and the coaching decision. We got plenty to get to. McMonagle here with you for another 2 hours taking your calls at 888-808-1019. Let's go to Steve in Rockland. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Chris. Okay, Chris. First of all, I want to talk about Bellinger, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you saw that throw he made this afternoon, okay? Now, I saw a game, and I'm sure this highlight's got to be on YouTube. He was playing right field, and there was a runner on second, and the ball was hit. It was a fly ball that was drifting toward the right field foul line. And he caught the ball, and he unleashed a throw without a bounce to the third baseman, and the guy was out at third. Now, I think he hurt his shoulder. He had some injuries since. I don't know if he could still do that, but I never forgot that play because maybe, and I can't remember, the only player that I ever saw who would even consider making a throw like that was Roberto Clemente. Okay? That's number one. Number two, Chris, I want you to think, when was the last time you saw a first baseman do an unassisted double play on a ground ball?
Yeah.
It's very rare.
I don't know what Mauricio was thinking. I don't know why he didn't just book for first base. I mean,
the second time. That's the second one he did. And then here's the thing. Since all of this talk about, the Yankees don't teach fundamentals. Zoom got to be fired.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've been gave myself a little homework assignment.
Oh.
And I've been watching these games just for the fundamental aspect of it. There need to be like a lot of fired managers.
100%. I've been saying it too. Nobody cares. And I understand why Yankee fans don't care, Steve. You know why they don't care, because we don't care about other teams. We care about our own team, and it's a problem for the Yankees. But there is no doubt. Luke, how many series have we seen it? We just saw it with the Mets, how many bad base running decisions did they make? You know, you mentioned the Mauricio, the one at second base where he runs into the out, standing still for an unassisted double play from the first baseman. You've got Jeff McNeil not scoring on that double. You've got Lindor getting doubled off on the line drive. You got tons of mistakes, tons. And then you look at the Cincinnati series when they played the Reds. My goodness,
that's led by
Francona. That's led by one of the great managers in baseball who wouldn't stand for this crap and is an old school manager. And they were awful. How many bad picked off at second base to end the inning? De La Cruz doesn't know he's the winning run. I mean, like.
He didn't know where to throw the ball.
He doesn't know where to throw. Yeah, it's we saw Ben Rice go back and tag after not getting off to a good jump and still score. Yeah, I mean, it was, we see it throughout baseball. I saw Pete Crow Armstrong didn't know how many outs there were. We see it all over the place. It has been an issue with Major League Baseball. It is not just the Yankees.
Thank you. And one thing, Yankees, it's not going to get any easier for a while. Seattle, the Cubs, All-Star, Atlanta, and then the Phillies. I mean, I looked at that schedule, man. They better hunker down. They better fuck up, because this is gonna be make or break. Every single team they're going to play for the next month has a lot of juice. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, no, thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. No, the schedule coming up is difficult for the New York Yankees, and then it opens up. It opens up in August and September. The reason why I don't put that much stock in that, or the reason I don't talk about it that much, is because we have seen it's about the Yankees. They lost to the Angels. You know, they've lost to the Red Sox, who are struggling. The Mets came in. I know they won the series, but they didn't play all that well and had terrible pitching matchups, still lost 2 out of 3. It's about the Yankees. It is not about their opponent. When they're playing well, they can beat anyone. When they're playing poorly, they can lose to anyone. But there's no doubt. Right now, they are off today, and then they have a 6-game homestand heading into the All-Star break against Seattle and the Cubs. Now, Seattle, I don't think, you know, Seattle's pitched very well as of late, and they obviously have the greatest hitting catcher in the sport right now and the home run leader in Cal Raleigh. But ultimately, their offense isn't that good at home against Seattle. It's a tough series. They're a good team. They're not a great team. They're a good team. It's a series that if they win, the Yankee fans poo-poo. Like, if this series happens in May and the Yankees take all three or two out of three, it's one of those, yeah, okay, so you beat Seattle. But it's a big series coming up. The Cubs are obviously one of the best teams in the National League. The Yankees have played the Cubs well over the last couple of years, but they haven't been as good as they are this year. So that's a tough stretch. Then off of the All-Star break, they're on the road, three in Atlanta, which obviously they are a talented team, but having a miserable season. And then three in Toronto, again, right back into Toronto, which is obviously going to be a huge series. Then they're home for Philadelphia and a weekend series against Philly, and then a four-game set against Tampa. That's the rest of July. So July is a three-game, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 home games and only 6 road games. So they are home for a lot of this in July, but it's Seattle, Chicago, Atlanta, Toronto, Philly, and Tampa. Those are all, for you know, pretty damn good teams. They're all playoff teams except for Atlanta. Right now, they're all sitting in playoffs, or you know, close to playoff spots, except for Atlanta. Then when they go into August, it opens up. It starts with Miami, in Miami, and then they go to Texas, who's having a down year but still dangerous. Then it's Houston for a three-game set. Minnesota, St. Louis, Tampa Bay, Boston, Washington, the White Sox. That's really where you're hoping. I know they don't play well against the division, which is the problem. Seattle's having St. Louis is having a better year than you would hope, but Minnesota, who they own, St. Louis, a quick two-game set against Tampa, Boston, and then they finish out the month Washington and Chicago. And they end the season with Chicago and Baltimore. Actually, the end of the season's even better. September is even better for them at the very end. The last from the last 2 weeks of September are, if you include Boston, who's under, you know, who's not playing all that well, but you can't consider it an easy series for the Yankees. They only won one game against them this year. But you've got on the road Boston, Minnesota, Baltimore, back home for White Sox, Baltimore. That's how the Yankees end the season. Boston, Minnesota, Baltimore, White Sox, Baltimore. That's a favorable schedule. Now, we'll see if Baltimore sells, but they haven't played well against the division, so it's easy to point at those games and say, oh, they're under 500 teams, oh, they're not playing well. The Yankees don't play well inside the division, which, again, is a bigger problem for me and more of one of the like these issues that consistently show up year after year. I'm less concerned about the June swoon and more concerned about the teams that know them best inside their division, exploit their weaknesses better than anybody else. Last year was the 8 stolen bases against the Red Sox. This year, the Blue Jays took every extra base and ran on every outfielder and absolutely killed them. Springer absolutely killed them. That was an ass-kicking of the highest order. They did it every which way. They outscored them. They outpitched them. They outplayed them. They out-hustled them. They did everything better. They kicked the crap out of the Yankees for 4 games. Mike in Queens. What's up, Mike?
Hey, what's up? You know, if you took Michael Jordan in his prime and you put him on this current Knicks team and you take away Brunson and Anthony Towns, he's not making the finals. And my point is, when Mike Brown made the finals with LeBron, it was literally 1 against 5. There wasn't even a single player aside from LeBron that was even bench player quality. So the job he did was phenomenal. The Kings were 30 games under 500 the previous season of Mike Brown. The same exact roster, player for player, they had the highest offensive rating in NBA history in his first season. So to me, when I look at coaching, I think coaching in the NBA is the least impactful at any sport. But really? In this rare case, yes, I just think in this rare, it's a make
or miss. You think it's less impactful than Major League Baseball?
Yeah, because in basketball, you can be wide open and miss a wide open shot, and guys hit perfectly contested shots. It's a make or miss league. So you can draw up the greatest play, and the guy missed a wide open shot. So I just think in basketball, it's very rare where a coach makes a big difference. I think this is one of those rare cases because the Warriors have not sniffed the finals since Mike Brown left. And I believe he was the brains behind that whole Warriors dynasty. And you look at statistically what he's done, minimum 700 games, he's top 5 in NBA history. as far as winning percentage goes. So I'm telling you right now, in 3 or 4 years, Mike Brown will be one of the top 2 or 3 greatest coaches in NBA history.
Whoa.
This guy's talent is off the charts. I'm telling you, he is special, and he has a huge upside.
Thank you for the call, Mike. One of the top 2 or 3 coaches in NBA history? I mean, that's a bit out there, brother. that's a bold statement. That is a bold statement. Look, I understand your point. I do. I mean, LeBron went to 9 straight NBA finals, so to suggest that, you know, Mike Brown, you know, took LeBron James and nobody else to the finals when other coaches couldn't, or, you know, if Jordan was on those teams, he wouldn't have got to the finals. Okay, but that, I don't know, that to me, that speaks more to LeBron's greatness than it does the coach's greatness. But okay. And then clearly, absolutely, with not only just the franchise that had lost however many games before getting there, was at the top of the professional sports list that the Jets currently reside on, longest playoff droughts in professional sports. Like, it was a franchise that could do nothing right for a decade and a half. And he came in and changed things. And yes, that offense that first year was particularly good. There's no doubt about it. He got you Andre Fox and that team to play really well. I don't hate the hire. I have issues with the way it went down. And I'm sorry. I can't say I know he's a better coach than Thibodeau. I can't tell you that. You might be able to tell me that. He did get to an NBA Finals. Tibbs has not. He had LeBron James. Tibbs has not. I mean, we all love Brunson. He's not LeBron James. So I can't consider the hire a major upgrade. Now, we know that it was more about changing things than it is about necessarily an upgrade. It doesn't have to be an upgrade. It just has to be a different voice, a different skill set for her coach, and try and develop some offensive continuity between the two stars. So it's not about necessarily finding the upgrade, but again, I would have liked one coming off of an Eastern Conference Finals appearance for the first time in 25 years. And the way they went about it, like, you might call him a top 2 or 3 coach in NBA history. The Knicks didn't act like that. The Knicks went out asking on every door if they could talk to their coach. They wanted Jason Kidd. They wanted Aduka. They wanted, all these coaches that they hoped would shake free. Jenkins, like, they wanted a whole bunch of different guys that they hoped would shake free. He's coming in here. He has to get back to the NBA Finals. You have to be the best team in the East. You have to get to the NBA Finals. Otherwise, it's not successful. He's going to have to deal with Jalen Brunson, who's, I don't know their relationship necessarily, but he'd love the last coach, and now he's got to handle having his father on the bench, and there's reports of that being a dynamic that has caused problems in the room. So you've got to come in here and take Karl-Anthony Towns, who's perceived as soft for his career, and there is reason behind that perception. So he's got to change that. He's got to find a way for him and Jalen Brunson to play together. He's got to take a dynamic that didn't work last year with, you know, Brunson's father being on the bench and the issues there. And he has to win, and he's got to be the best team in the East. He's got to get to an NBA championship, or it's a failure. And he's doing it, and they're telling us he's their third or fourth best choice. But now, to be fair, it didn't sound like, for all of the extensive search and, you know, due diligence I've heard, there are some reports that they talked to other coaches. But let's be honest, it felt like once they were told no, they talked to 2 guys. And really, Mike Brown was, from the jump, the guy. So I'll give them that at least. It sounded like once they were told no by Jason Kidd and Dallas, and once they couldn't get different guys out of contracts to come coach, he seemed like the guy they wanted. But you're talking about selling a franchise on a third choice, a guy who went to 1 NBA Finals with the best player of the generation, couldn't last in Sacramento even after having that offensive explosion in his first season. And he's coming in here right now with the, and here's the thing, It might work. It might not. I knew what Tibbs was. I knew what the team was going to be. I knew who they were. I knew how they would perform, on what level. I knew the floor of a Tibbs-led Knick team. This is the most important season in the franchise, maybe in history, and over the last 30 years for sure. We all know what's gone on, right? Turner goes to Milwaukee, and there's no Halliburton. So a team that we looked at as a team that was the pain in the ass, the team they couldn't beat, the team that was in the NBA Finals given the best team in basketball, the Oklahoma City Thunder, everything they could want and more, forcing a game seven. This was going to be the team that was going to be the hump that they couldn't get over. And now they move Turner and they don't have Halliburton. I don't know what the Pacers are going to be, but they're not going to be what they were this year. Giannis might still be unhappy in Milwaukee. Dame is hurt and gone. They added Turner to the team. And they'll add more. I think they did. I'm blanking on who it was. I thought I saw a report that they added somebody. But I don't know how good they're going to be. Cleveland is a team that has yet to prove they can be tested in the postseason and come through. Although they're talented, have a good coach, have a star player, and had a hell of a regular season. And Boston, without Tatum and shipping out Porzingis, they look completely different. The Knicks have the best pathway to an NBA Finals they have had in 30 years. And it's just scary to me to head into that with a coach that I don't know if it's going to work. It's really a lateral move when you think about how good the coach is. Like, I don't view him as a better coach than Thibodeau, and maybe he'll turn out to be, but right now I don't view him as that. So they had a lateral move just for change's sake heading into the most important season in 30 years when I knew what they were with Tibbs, and I don't know what they're going to be with Brown. Maybe it's better. Maybe it's worse. It just feels like a crappy year to go into it with instability and being unsure about how the pieces are going to fit and what this coach can do. So I don't think it's a bad hire. I don't hate him as a coach, but the process in which they picked him was laughable. And I don't care what anybody else tells me. They ended up with a good coach. They ended up with this. They fired Tibbs and went through this ridiculous laugh. I mean, they're being laughed at by Shams. They're being laughed at by Barkley. They're asking for everybody under the sun. And then it takes forever. They go through the draft. They go through free agency. They hire the coach after all of that. And it's just Mike Brown, who nobody would have been excited about. Here's the thing. For all the Knick fans who thought they wanted Tibbs fired, If you told them then that it's going to be Mike Brown is going to be the guy that replaced him, everybody like, really? Okay, maybe one more year at Tibbs. I bet you that would have been the response from a lot of Knick fans. Now, of course, they're going to try and sell themselves on the idea that what this last caller just tried to sell me on. He went to the NBA Finals with one player. He turned around a Sacramento Kings team that was terrible for years. He was part of a dynasty coaching staff. Okay. Again, not a terrible hire. I don't hate him. I hate how Tibbs was fired. I hate the instability in a franchise that was just finding stability. I hate the idea they're going in unknown into the most important season with a wide-open Eastern Conference that has been for the last 30 years, and it was all for the sake of a lateral coaching change. I don't know how you can be overly excited about it. We'll find out. He's not a terrible head coach. I don't think it's a disaster. He's got experience. He's coached several teams. He's been in big games. He's coached big games. He's went to an NBA Finals. He's had offensive production. I'm on board. But it doesn't change the fact that they have a lot of proving to me. I have to now know that the owner isn't involved in every decision. I need to know that this is going to work. I need to know that Rick Brunson being on the bench isn't an issue. I need to know these players are going to be happy with their roles. Like, they just signed two bench players, and that's what pisses me off too. Like, again, it's not even just about Brown, We yell and yell and yell, Tibbs doesn't play a bench. And then it feels like this year they're going to go into the season with the best bench they've had in any point in Tibbs' career with the Knicks. Like, they go out and get Jackson. They've got some depth. They get the big man from Philadelphia. And it feels like, okay, like, he wouldn't have played these guys? Like, he still would have just went with either Hart or Mitchell Robinson or Deuce McBride, whoever's the starter, because there's some thought that maybe you could see Hart coming off the bench. But whatever the case may be, those three guys, that's it. He would still had a six-man rotation. We had a seven-man rotation and said Jackson's not playing. Like, we all know that's not the case. He would have played these guys. They finally put a complete team around him, and instead of giving this coach who's earned it an opportunity, they fired him for a lateral move in hopes of change. I don't like hope heading into a huge season. I don't like hope when I knew what I had. And I know many people view it as, well, you knew you had a coach who couldn't get him over the hump. Okay. Who's stopping them now? Is the defending Boston Celtics of last year going to be there? Are the Indiana Pacers, who just went to the Eastern Conference Finals and then the NBA Finals in back-to-back seasons, are they going to be standing in front of them? Like, the two obstacles are gone. He deserved another chance. This wasn't a move that had to be made. The bench got better. He would have played it. I'm still just upset that Tibbs isn't the coach of this team. And Mike Brown is not enough to make me forget that. And we'll see if I'm wrong. And hopefully I am.
Get the scuttlebutt on your favorite teams here on The Fan.
All right, 3:36. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. You know, another piece of news that came out today that really surprised me was the firing of the GM and the manager, Rizzo and Martinez, out in Washington for the Nats. Now, they have been bad this year. They've been worse than what people had expected. Like, we had thought that this was a young, up-and-coming team, that, you know, they could, you know, make some noise in the division a little bit. I mean, not, you know, compete for the division title necessarily, but I don't think anybody thought that they would have, you know, they would be four games back of the Marlins at this point. I know Atlanta is even worse than that, believe it or not. But 37-53 is probably a little worse than what the Nationals were expecting this season to be. But they are filled with young talent. And I know it hasn't, like I'm saying, hasn't culminated in enough wins. But I would say, like, if you look at the Juan Soto trade that they made with the Padres a couple years ago, for an owner who just fired these guys, an owner who needed the trade made because he wasn't going to pay him. They talked contract. He wasn't going to go where Soto wanted. They have to trade him. And the return has probably been, I don't know if you can find a better example. Like, outside of Herschel Walker and the Cowboys and the Vikings, like, that's about as good a return for the great player as, like, we've ever seen. Like, the Red Sox traded Mookie Betts. It was a disaster. They got, like, Jeter Downs, who I don't even think is in baseball anymore, is toiling away somewhere in the minor leagues, and Verdugo. Those were the two big pieces of the Mookie Betts trade. Verdugo, I know he was on the World Series roster last year for the New York Yankees, but he can't stay with the Braves as they're 13.5 back in the division, and Jeter Downs isn't even playing right now. Like, that's why you don't trade those guys. But the return they got from Soto, whether it be Wood and everybody else, Abrams, like, that return has really been remarkable. They won a championship together in 2019. It's been slow go, no doubt about it, since that moment. But you're starting to really reap the rewards, although not with victories, I get. But still, the youth is really exciting there. And they have the first pick in the draft this year, you know, and that's on Sunday. They're firing the GM right before the draft. Like, him and his team have been doing draft prep. They have a board. I know it's not, you know, it's not as sexy as the NFL and NBA drafts, but a lot of work goes into it. And they're just going to change directions less than a week before the draft? It's just odd timing. It's odd timing for what happened, what's going on there. Just very bizarre. And, you know, Rizzo's done a decent enough job there. Again, won a championship. Had to, you know, lost Bryce Harper, turned around and won a championship. Had to trade Juan Soto. Got as good a return for Juan Soto as you could possibly get. Now, again, it was with a couple of years control, so it was a big-time trade. But you do not see. It is very rare you see the great player move, and you can honestly say that the team that shipped him won the trade, or at least you feel like they got a really good haul and you feel comfortable with the trade. Most of the time, you're like, oh my God, what a disaster. For the truly great player. That is very, it's very rare to feel this good about a trade years later. And the Nationals do, and for good reason. They've got really good players. You fire the manager? Okay, I get it. He's underachieving with a young group. It's tough to say that, but at least I can understand that. Firing the GM a week before the draft, after he executed for your organization one of the great trades that you could possibly make when being forced to trade away a great player. Like, surprising timing. 888-808-1019. Nick Monagle here with you on The Fan. Let's get back to the calls. Travis in the Bronx. What's up, Travis?
Chris, good morning. How
good
are you?
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks. I think what you were saying earlier about Mike Brown and Thibodeau, I think a lateral move is probably what the Knicks realistically were going to make anyway. I mean, there was no Bill Parcells. There's no Pat Riley. You know, I think the home run would be Jay Wright. I don't even think Jason Kidd was... I'm glad that they didn't get him because I'm not really sold on Jason Kidd. And I think the pressure of bringing Kidd in would probably be too much for his ability. I don't think he's that good of a coach.
What do you mean the pressure? What pressure?
Because I think everybody feels like Jason Kidd is on a different level. And I just don't think that he is. And I think we would be setting ourselves up if we had Jason Kidd because he hasn't done... Yes, he got the Mavericks to the finals 2 years ago. But other than that, he's created conflict. He's created, you know, situations. He's made franchises look bad with, you know, personal behavior. And I don't think the Knicks need he's good at distractions. And the Knicks don't need distractions. Like you said, next year is a huge year. I think a lateral move shows that this was probably more player-driven than anyone is giving it credit because you have to believe that the players were informed about who they were talking to. And I think what the Knicks did by talking to some of the, but requesting permission to talk to coaches that were under contract, they're just doing due diligence to have those conversations. Maybe they wanted Jason Kidd more than Mike Brown, but the reality is there's nothing if you look at their record. If you look at the history of their coaching resume, there's nothing that really separates the two. And Mike Brown, at one point, was a hot commodity, and not just because he coached LeBron James. I just think that a lateral move for the Knicks is probably the safest bet, and I think you don't want to disrupt things too much because I think next year is the biggest year that the Knicks could have.
Yeah, I guess. If your point is that Jason Kidd had the bigger, you know, bust or bigger disaster probability than Mike Brown, where Mike Brown, you know, might not be the guy or get them over the hump, but you feel confident he's going to give you, you know, no controversy, no issues with the players or whatever the case, and you could feel Jason Kidd has brought a lot of turbulence to places at times. Okay, I get that. It's not even that I think Jason Kidd's the better coach. I think Jason Kidd recently just took a team to the NBA Finals. I think Jason Kidd was one of the again, this is probably bias here. I mean, as a player, one of the smartest guys I've ever seen on the floor. He had a relationship with Jalen Brunson, had coached him. And it just felt like that was their top choice. I'm big on that. Like, again, I can't tell you why. You know, we can go into different reasons, but do I know if Jason Kidd would have been the better coach than Brown or Tibbs? I have no idea, but here's the point. The Knicks clearly wanted him first. I'm big on, especially when you fire a coach that took you to the Eastern Conference Finals and has resurrected this franchise. To me, you don't fire him and go, oh, well, we'll find somebody. There's decent candidates out there. We'll talk to somebody. He had to go. Like, I don't agree with that. So on that premise, it's tough for me to just say, oh, okay, well, Mike, lateral move is the best they were going to do. Okay, but if that's the best you were going to do, maybe don't make the decision to go look for a lateral move. Maybe just keep the guy you had. Now, I know the players and the exit meetings and all of that, guy said they wouldn't play for him. Okay. We'll see. Again, Mike Brown is not a bad hire. I don't disagree with that, the concept of that. It's just, it doesn't excite me. And I view it as a lateral move. And I don't know what it could not work. It could really not work. It could be just a bad mix of coach and players. It could be. And this year is too important to take that risk for me. I wouldn't have taken that risk. Because as unhappy as the players were, we saw how they performed. And they went to the Eastern Conference Finals and they beat the defending Boston Celtics, a defending champion Boston Celtics, and they came from behind twice, down 20 on the road. Like, I'll take that guy one more year after his only first year with the with this roster, and the idea they just improved it to a point where they actually have a bench. Hector in the Bronx. What's up, Hector?
Hey, how you doing, C-Mac?
What's up, brother? How are you?
I'm great, man. Well, before I get to my topic, I just want you to know I went to Italy last month with my wife for our anniversary, and they had plenty of eggs at the hotel, or where I went to at least. They had all kind of eggs and breakfast stuff that you would like, bacon.
Oh, they did.
And stuff like that.
Okay, yeah. No, I'm not staying at a hotel. I'm staying at a house that my father-in-law and his brother are renting, and it's in a town in Sicily. So I'm told that don't expect eggs for breakfast, that it's pastries and coffee. But maybe they're right. Wrong, and I'll be able to find it. I'll go to a hotel. Give me the name. Well, I don't care. I'll figure it out.
Well, if you're in Sicily, it's a whole different ballgame. I was in Rome, so like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So it might be different. But
yeah,
as far as my Yankees are concerned, I'm just concerned about as far as like the fundamentals. Like, whatever happened to baseball, man, with the fundamentals, learning how to bunt over runners. Like with Volpe, he's not a, you know, someone like that with speed should be taught how to bunt, at least work on that. I think it'll improve his game and make him more valuable to the team if he learn how to just simply bunt, playing a bunt down.
Again, the small ball argument. How I've heard the small ball argument. There are guys who should be able to bunt. There's no doubt about it. I think bunting is a part of the game, especially now in extra innings. It usually comes up. Most of the time, I don't agree with it. Baseball today, whether it's analytics or whatever bad word you want to use, there's 27 outs, and the new thought of baseball is I don't like giving any away. And I can tell you watching the last couple that have happened to our baseball teams that are under controversy because what the hell were they thinking? Jazz, a couple of last week, you know, bunting in a situation that made absolutely no sense. And in the Saturday game, Juan Soto bunting in the first inning is just the dumbest thing I've ever seen. I mean, why would you give Carlos Rodon an out? Now, it ended up being okay because he hangs a slider to Nimmo, which was a hideous pitch and typical Carlos Rodon, bad Carlos Rodon. Get ahead, 1-2, and hang a slider. It's unexplainable why that happens in big games. He's going to have to figure that out. But that bunt was you're one of the best hitters on the planet. You make $765 million. It's first and second, nobody out, and you're going to lay down a bunt? in the first inning off of Carlos Rodon? That is a mind-numbing decision. So, but yes, could Volpe learn how to bunt, move guys over? They actually did that in this game. They scored runs doing that. They scored runs on ground balls and moving runners over and doing all that. And few and far between, they need to be much better at it. But the bunting angle, look, it's just not what players are taught. It's the fundamentals of the game. It's not just the Yankees. It's everybody. But Anthony Volpe's not going to turn into a hitter who drops down bunts and beats them out. He's not going to be that kind of player. Should he be somebody who can move a runner over with a bunt and you feel confident in him laying down a bunt? Of course. Of course. And a lot of players aren't who should be. Peraza looks like he doesn't know how to lay a bunt down. The dude can't hit. Can you imagine? Like, again, baseball is just different. He is literally, I saw a stat from Katie Sharp on Twitter. She does a great job. Go follow her. She gives out a lot of stats. Oswald Peraza, is literally like the 321st best hitter out of like 327 players. He is at the bottom. When you see him at the plate, you are watching one of, if not the worst offensive player in all of Major League Baseball. That's how bad Peraza is. And he looks uncomfortable laying down a bunt. How can you be a bench light hitting infield player and not know how to bunt? That is insane. Forget Volpe, who was the top sixth prospect in all of baseball. I get it. It's still with his skill set, he should bunt and be able to. But at least on that level, you know, he's been a leadoff to. He's been hitting 1-2-3-4 in every team he's played for. Like, I get it on some level. And Oswald Peraza probably the same. But you can't be in the major leagues, being one of the worst hitters in the game, being a bench player and a light hitting infielder, and not be able to learn how to handle the bat and bunt. That's insane. But it's throughout baseball. We see it all over the place. Go rewatch the Yankees-Cincinnati Reds games and tell me that Terry Francona's teams know how to bunt. It was terrible. It was terrible. It is a problem throughout baseball. That's not to excuse the Yankees. I'm just saying, we point to it like, here. And here's the issue I have with it. We'll point to it and say, this is why they can't win. And my only issue with that is, yes, it certainly hampered them, it certainly cost them, and it needs to get better. But how can you tell me something that every team in baseball struggles with? Like, literally every team. How can you tell me that's the reason they can't win when nobody's good at it? Nobody's good at small ball. Everyone makes base running mistakes. Now, we saw in the one of the issues that came up in the aftermath of the World Series of the Dodgers was the relay throws from the outfield and the hitting the cutoff man. And that had absolutely popped its head up in the Toronto series a couple of different times. Like, and it's not only like Dominguez, it's not only that Dominguez, like the fear of him dropping a pop up or Dominguez, you know, misreading a line drive right at him. You watch Dominguez play. He doesn't cut the ball off. He allows runners to take the base. Like, he's just not a good out. He's not a great outfielder. He just isn't. I wanted him in the lineup. I want him in the lineup every day because of his offense, and he's not going to kill you out in left field. But a ball off the wall to left, guys take second base. There's just no doubt. They run on Dominguez. They run on everybody outside of Judge. I mean, the throws into the infield aren't good. Like, that's a weakness of the Yankee team, absolutely. And there are some teams who do it better, and there are teams who do the fundamentals better than the Yankees, but it is not exclusive to the New York Yankees. And again, give me a series that's the reason. Give me the playoff series outside of the World Series, and not to diminish that, that's a huge deal. And it's absolutely part of why they lost the World Series. But outside of the World Series, because we talk about, oh, it's every year, give me the other series that the Yankees lost because of poor fundamentals. They lose because they don't hit. If you want to talk about offensive fundamentals and running the moving the runners over and driving in runs with runners in scoring position, okay. But baseball, infield defense, controlling the run game, all that stuff, they lose because they don't score runs.